You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas F. Urban of the law firm of Urban & Falk. I'm here today representing Jane Washburn Robinson of the trustee of the Jane Washburn Robinson Living Trust. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Robinson is an elderly trustee who's been protecting two unique historical properties for generations since 1988. This is for future generations. For 16 years prior to defendants moving next door, she had no problems doing so. As this court is aware from the briefs, this dispute involves the actions of these neighbors who have interfered with my client's protection of the two historical houses by flooding the properties and ignoring easements intended to safeguard my client's properties. Defendants have run roughshod over my client, causing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage to the foundation and other elements of these two historic properties, and continue to do further damage. We are here today in a case in which the circuit court dismissed the substantial bulk of my client's case a mere 5 days before trial, after having overruled the same objections on these same claims 10 months prior to that hearing. In doing so, the circuit court denied my client the right to have these claims, which involved contested factual matters heard by a jury of her peers. 404 Duke Street is a majestic standalone building house with four floors rising 60 feet above the street. Built around 1802, it's been the home to numerous Virginia luminaries. The house has four windows that face 406 Duke Street, which is owned by the defendants, including the very important kitchen window, which you can see obstructed at Joint Appendix 289 to 292. Immediately behind and adjacent to 404 Duke Street is 303 South Royal, a townhouse open only on two sides, the front and the back, and it was built in 1798. It has three windows for light and air in the back, which faces 406 Duke Street. Combined, 404 Duke Street and 303 South Royal, the two properties owned by my clients, span 80 feet along the side of 406 Duke Street. Defendants have owned their property since 2004 and have denied plaintiff access to the seven windows and the ability to keep and maintain the western side of these properties for 11 years, since 2008. The first of our five assignments involves the circuit court's erroneous determination on a plea and bar that the trespasses and nuisances alleged by the Robinson Trust were of a continuous rather than intermediate nature and thus barred by the statute of limitations.
I think you mean intermittent
nature. Intermittent, yes, Your Honor. Pursuant to Virginia Code Section 8.01336, plaintiff requested that a jury hear this plea and bar no less than five times, the first time in written opposition to the plea and bar. As a matter of law, the circuit court was required to submit the plea to a jury if it was to consider evidence. The circuit court did consider evidence, including discovery responses attached to the defendant's plea memorandum, which established intermittent trespasses and nuisances. The circuit court even acknowledged the assertion that there was a lack of water intrusion for 5 to 6 months of the year when the sprinklers were turned off. The circuit court made a factual determination without basis in the amended complaint that, quote, the plaintiff has alleged continuing trespass and continuing nuisance which began prior to December 4th, 2010.
Can you tell from, or what's your position on whether the trial court was relying solely on the pleadings or the pleadings plus some evidence?
Well, going to that very last point, Justice Kelsey, it's clear that the circuit court purports to only be looking at the amended complaint. But to make that finding, there's nowhere in the amended complaint that talks about any water intrusion prior to mid-2011, any specific water intrusion. So the court had to look outside the amended complaint to make the determination that plaintiff had alleged continuing trespasses and nuisances prior to December 4th, 2010, 7-8 months before.
But your larger point is, even looking at the complaint cold, it's not clear that it is a continuing, non-intermittent series of water.
Right. That was actually my very next point. Moreover, the circuit court ignored there was specific mention of intermittent trespass in the amended complaint that the circuit court ignored, and that's in paragraph 157 of the amended complaint, as well as there's information in the wherefore clause, Roman numeral 4. The circuit court's ruling was based on the same language which the same court, a mere 10 months earlier, had interpreted as being ambiguous, whether it stated a continuous or intermittent trespasses and nuisances. In March 2016, the 10 months before, the circuit court had permitted discovery to determine which type of invasions these were. Nonetheless, when it heard the plea and bar in January 2017, it ignored all the evidence from discovery in granting the plea and bar. Its dismissal after discovery, and a mere 5 days before a jury trial was scheduled to begin, ignored this court's admonition in Forest Lakes that a trial court must carefully consider the factual context, not labels, surrounding each intrusion in making the continuous and intermittent determination. The circuit court failed to consider the factual context of the current dispute and ruled solely based on its own construction of the amended complaint, ignoring substantial discovery that established intermittent invasions because of a 5-6 month cessation of watering, including plaintiff's interrogatory answers that were actually attached to the memorandum in support of defendant's plea, as well as defendant's own answers to interrogatories. Moreover, discovery showed that this was not one monolithic trespass and nuisance. As I mentioned, there was 80 feet of property. Now, some of the trespasses were in the front of 404 Duke Street in a storage area. Some of the other water intrusions were in the middle of 404 Duke Street, yet others were under the stairs, which is farther back in 404 Duke Street, and yet others were in 303 South Royal, a separate property. This was illustrated.
This question. We're trying to streamline this so that you can use your time
sure.
effectively with all these assignments of error. Your position is that it's not necessary for you to have a motion to leave to amend because the pleadings laid it out properly in the first place. That's number one, correct?
Yes, that there was sufficient information in the pleadings, yes.
But if the trial court was to find that it wasn't sufficient, it was a further error not to allow you to amend the trespass and nuisance claim.
Well, first it was an error for the trial court to determine it on a plea and bar.
Right.
Then it was an error for the court not to consider the factual context, you know, the fact that the water was turned off for 6 months, and yet another error to not allow amendment, because there's more than enough facts to establish an intermittent trespass,
right.
And
yeah.
All she would be doing would be conforming the pleadings to the evidence that had been adduced in 10 months worth of discovery that the court had allowed.
Given the relatively brief time that you have, can you move to the perpetual easement question having to do with air and light?
Yes, Your Honor.
Light?
I'd be glad to. The trial court found that the easement for light and air was vague, ambiguous, and therefore unenforceable, which ignored the easement drafter's intent to protect the access of light and air to plaintiff's openings, specifically the several windows facing defendant's property. These drafters created an easement that clearly identifies the openings to be protected, those on the western side of the property, and the interest to be protected, that there not be a diminution of light and air, that the openings be kept for the purpose of admitting light and air. As this court, Justice Kelsey in Tvarak, noted, easements for light and air were one of the few restrictive covenants running with the land recognized under English common law. Despite this fact that such easements go back hundreds of years, defendants have not provided this court with one single decision in which another court has struck a written easement for light and air on the grounds of vagueness. So you would be the first court to do so. In the present case,
our case law suggests that if it's an express easement of that nature, that the court has the duty to try to resolve any ambiguity that it perceives exists. Now, I want to focus on that in the relatively short time that you have. The easement in Section 2 provided that this 3-foot strip of land shall forever be and remain open and free of all buildings and structures. Now, I understand that, but there's a conjunction later, and it says, and, except as aforesaid, the same shall be and remain an open yard. Your position, it seems to me, if I understand it correctly, is that the trial court paid attention to the first clause and not attention to the second clause, or at the very least gave the same definition in the second clause as in the first, rendering the second clause completely meaningless.
Absolutely. You've stated probably better than I have in any of my briefs. And that is a separate and distinct easement from the light and air. Now, appellees have tried to sort of conflate the two, but they're not the same easement. The light and air is a separate easement from the open yard. And as you pointed out, there was two provisions in that easement, both about the buildings and structures, and then the open yard. And the construction that the circuit court gave is not reasonable because, combined with the circuit court's ruling on light and air provision, the defendants, it allows the defendants to plant trees and place other objects right next to plaintiff's property, the entire length of it. So therefore, how is plaintiff supposed to access its windows in order to keep and maintain them? If there's obstructions, there's no way that's why the drafters had this provision, to keep that area open so that the dominant estate could access the openings. Moreover, there's the provision about the unlimited number of chimneys that can go out 3 feet. And as it's identical, the 3 feet chimneys are the same as the 3 foot median. Well, if there's sprinkler heads, if there's lights, if there's trees, if there's bushes, how is the dominant estate supposed to build any chimney in that space? They can't.
You're down to 2 minutes, 23 seconds if you'd like to reserve it.
I'd like to reserve it, Tom. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is John McGavin. I'm here on behalf of DJ and Nels Nordquist, homeowners at 404 Duke Street in Alexandria, Virginia. We respectfully ask that this court affirm the decisions of Judge Kemmler from the Circuit Court for the City of Alexandria. As there are 5 assignments of error, any that I don't reach in today's oral argument, I respectfully ask that you consider what we've submitted on the pleadings. We believe the court correctly analyzed the amended complaint and decided this case on the 4 corners of the amended complaint to determine that this cause of action was barred by the statute of limitations. At Joint Appendix page 461, Judge Kemmler pointed out that she was considering only the 4 corners of the complaint. That was at our hearing on January 25, 2017. Then at Joint Appendix pages 473 to 474, she again stated she was deciding this case solely based upon the 4 corners of the amended complaint. Then in the same hearing again, asked for clarification of her ruling. At Joint Appendix page 476, she stated, I am deciding this case solely upon the 4 corners of the amended complaint.
Let me ask you this. Assume that that's obviously what the judge said. I'm not questioning you on that. Can you actually resolve this on the 4 corners? If the question is it continuous or is it intermittent, can you actually resolve that without taking evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. The amended complaint is filled with allegations of persistent and consistent water intrusion. Paragraphs 86, 99, 100, 101, 102, 103, 104, 106, 109, 111, and 153, all allege a continuous, persistent, unrelenting, and continuing through the present time, water encroachment.
But is there nothing in the complaint itself that also reveals that the problem didn't exist in the winter months when the irrigation system was turned off?
Never once. They don't say that. That's something the council has gone beyond the record to add. So what's happened here is that there is an extensive argument that's been made in this case that goes well beyond the amended complaint, Your Honor. This amended complaint makes no reference to the system being turned off. Not once. The only place where the word intermittent appears is at paragraph 157 of the amended complaint. They talk about an intermittent trespass. Otherwise,
I realize the discovery and the complaint are two different documents and are governed by different rules. I realize that. But it wasn't a surprise to you because you had discovery documents that demonstrated that this problem didn't occur in the winter months. And there was a reference to intermittent in that paragraph. And the combination of the two, it seems to me, put you on notice that this is something that was going to require evidence to determine, was it intermittent, was it continuous? That's my question to you. And if that's not the case, then why wasn't it error to deny the petition to amend?
So, simply stated, Your Honor, Mrs. Robinson made so many different statements in the course of these proceedings. She said that she'd been having water problems before the Nordquist moved in. Then she said she started having water problems in the winter. She actually, in the course of these proceedings, when the system was turned off, if we get into the facts, she said she was having water intrusion from our sprinkler system when it wasn't even energized. So, sure, I'm aware that there is an issue there, but there are so many inconsistent and, frankly, untrue statements from Mrs. Robinson that the initial inquiry in this case is, what did they plead? Without judging the facts, which were wildly inconsistent, what did they plead and why did they plead it? Here's why, Your Honor. They had to plead a continuous harm, because otherwise, when the sprinkler system goes on for 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes at night every day, if they were going to have to try to prove a separate and distinct harm and damage each day, they couldn't do it. Plus, they had statements from Mrs. Robinson going back to 2005 where she was talking about having water intrusion and having problems with her downspouts. They had to plead a continuous harm because if they didn't, they couldn't prove their damages. So it made absolute sense to me for them to plead a continuous harm to try to take advantage of this accrual so they could have one lump sum damage, which is what they were trying to claim. So that's why it made absolute sense to me that they were claiming a continuous harm. You can't separate out the damages like Cooper versus Whiting Oil and any number of other cases which say each time there's a harm, you have to prove the discrete damage. There's no way with a sprinkler system that goes on for 10 minutes twice a day that you're going to be able to say, well, we had this water intrusion related to the sprinkler system that went off at 4 o'clock for 10 minutes. It just made no sense. They had to do it by continuous.
Counsel, I'd like to follow on that same line of questions. I'm looking at the paragraphs that you cited. Paragraph 104, for example, talks about continuous encroachment.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in fact, the sprinkler system itself is continuous. It was put in there, and it hasn't been removed.
Correct.
And the sprinkler heads that are above the ground are a continuous offense to the easement, is their allegation. But then I'm looking at, when it talks about the water damage itself, they allege that it's because of the sprinkler system. They allege that there was never any water damage based upon rainfall. And I'm going to focus in on paragraph 101. Where it says plaintiff has suffered persistent, doesn't say continuous, it was persistent and damaging encroachments of water. And I just simply looked to a dictionary definition of the term persistent, persistent as continuing to exist or endure over a prolonged period. Now, that doesn't imply continuous. That doesn't imply that it's every single day or every single minute or every single hour. It simply implies that as long as that water system has been there, we have suffered damage that we didn't suffer when it was rainfall. Pardon me for thinking that I might be using common sense, but it seems that when you turn the system on, you're going to have water, and when you turn the system off, it's eventually going to stop flowing into the basement. And that's what their proof showed during discovery. Now, I'm just not getting it.
Your Honor, the other things, there's so much evidence in this case that's selectively before you, but the point of it is they also alleged at various times it was leaking. So there were allegations that even when it wasn't activated, that it leaked, that there was an underground leak. There was also claims in that same paragraph at 101 that they did not only use the sprinkler, but there were other watering methods that they complained about.
During discovery, were there still allegations of the leaking?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
During the discovery, were the allegations made and held to, not surrendered, of leaking?
They changed over time. There were initial allegations that it leaked, and then the leak was repaired, but parsing that all together was extremely confusing as to what the plaintiff's claim was. It was a bit of a moving target as the matter moved along.
I'm sorry, you go ahead. Go ahead and finish your answer. I apologize.
I'm done, Your Honor. I'll wait for the next question.
It seems to me that's a jury issue. If you have a system that is leaking, that is continuously leaking, then the statute of limitations may have run. If you have a system that is working properly, and when you turn it on, you get water in the adjacent basement, and when you turn it off, eventually the water quits going to the adjacent basement, then under Forest Lakes, the statute of limitations may not have run.
It seems to me, Your Honor, that the difficulty here for the plaintiff goes back to the fundamental question that I've raised, which is there's no way, practically, common sense, borrowing your term, that you can prove a case relying upon a water sprinkler system that comes on for 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at night, and that's it. This is a tiny yard, and claim a disparate and distinct damage. So I understand the court's concern about what all the evidence is. There are mountains of evidence. But fundamentally, when this came up to be heard, the court, Judge Kemmler, was of the mindset that she did not quite understand the law and the complaint the first time it was heard. Over our objection, they were allowed to amend 2 months before trial. The earliest date we could get before the court was 5 days before trial. And at that point, as the court said, the light bulb went off that these allegations, fundamentally, the plaintiff's claim is this is a continuing harm and it accrued prior to the operative date. I know there was a question that was asked whether that accrual date was included within the original complaint, but I would encourage the court to consider Joint Appendix 417 to 419, and during those pages there was a colloquy between Judge Kemmler and counsel in which counsel acknowledged that there was damage that occurred prior to December 4, 2010, so that although that wasn't in the amended complaint, counsel conceded that, and there was no dispute on that point in regard to what was being presented.
That wouldn't be fatal if the damage was intermittent, if the damage occurred in the summer months, but not in the winter months.
I don't think just having it. When you say the summer months, we're talking about April to October. So it's not just June, July, August. We're talking about April to October when this system runs. So under the case law, it doesn't have to be constantly for the court to find it's a continuous harm. And it's the structure itself that is in place. It is a permanent fixture in the ground, and it is the harm once it is installed that causes the damage.
Can I ask you about that permanent fixture in the ground in
yes,
the context
sir.
Of the 1969 easement? Does the record reflect that that permanent structure in the ground is actually in the area where the other party is free to construct chimneys according to the easement itself?
Some of the sprinkler heads are over the line into the 3-foot median. But that open median does not have anything in it other than ladders and toys, and there was a section of a trellis, the footprint of the trellis that came across, which has since been removed. And that's a subject for proceedings that the plaintiff non-suited and has refiled but not served. That is still pending back in the circuit court regarding the injunctive relief and any remedy for that, Your Honor.
Are you suggesting that the issue of the interpretation of Section 2 as far specifically with regard to the question of remain an open yard has been removed from the case before the court now?
Your Honor, we conceded that that was a valid and viable easement. The issue that the court had to decide in that discussion was whether or not ladders, toys, etc. Were covered by the definition of open yard. And the court interpreted the easement to say you have to keep it clear for buildings and structures, chimney or chimneys, but a ladder or a child's toy or adding mulch or flowers or a flower bed do not violate the open yard.
Doesn't that exclude altogether the second part of the easement that's joined by the conjunction and? The same shall be and remain open yard. It seems to me that what has happened is that the scope of that easement, the actual extent to which it is enforceable, has been limited to all buildings and structures by the trial court, but the easement itself is bigger than that.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the 3-foot easement is to remain open and free of all buildings, and the term open yard is by way of clarification of what that means. In other words, it's to be kept open so that Mrs. Robinson can have access to her windows on the side and build a chimney if need be.
Under that interpretation, presumably you could plant foliage, trees, shrubs, all kinds of things. They would not be structures and buildings, but they could actually do exactly what the easement is there to prevent, and that is cut off light and air and all of the things that were the reason for the easement in the first place. You could also dump a mountain of mulch or gravel or whatever you thought to put that are not buildings and structures, but they clearly interfere with light and air, which seems to me the reason why there's a conjunction and says that this shall be and remain an open yard. So how do you deal with that?
Your Honor, my time has expired. May I extend to answer your question?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think we deal with that in terms of common sense, Your Honor, because the plaintiff's position was the fact that there were toys in the open yard was a violation and they needed injunctive relief. So there is a balancing and analysis of what is an open yard. So somewhere between planting grass and adding topsoil and having a flower bed and a mountain, as you say, of mulch or rocks is an interpretation of common sense and fairness. And the facts in this case are to be determined by the court whether there is a need for injunctive relief that the Nordquists have somehow violated that open yard provision. That injunctive relief, Your Honor, is part of the case that is still pending, non-suited, and refiled after this court, after the court's ruling. In other words, they non-suited those provisions, and then before the expiration of the 6 months, refiled and has not been served.
Well, now that's an action seeking a remedy.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the issue itself, the definition. The proper definition of the 1969 easement, particularly Section 2, is in this case.
I understand that, yes. But there is within the analysis of every... May I continue?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Your Honor. There is an analysis contained in within every easement of some level of common sense. And the court's interpretation of this is that the overarching analysis, the overarching requirement is to keep this free of buildings and structures. And that is what Judge Kemmler decided. We believe that's the correct interpretation and that it does not have to be plowed down to essentially a desert, which is what the plaintiff wants us to do.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McGavin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to go back to that last point because, with all due respect to opposing counsel, there is trees and bushes. Defendants have planted that within the median. There are trees and bushes within 3 feet of the property obstructing my client's ability to access the openings. So it's not just toys and I mean, it is actual, they are planting up until the day, and I know I'm going outside the record, right up to the property, which is, the property line is the building, just to clarify. Going further, I think counsel had a lot of discussion about various facts. I think those would be interesting for a jury, and I think it would be appropriate to have a jury trial regarding the damages and things like that, but they're not appropriate for the plea and bar, and that's what we're here on, is a plea and bar. And so whether, you know, he considers my client not to be credible or whatever, then that's up to the jury to determine. I would say she's quite credible.
Can you address his argument about First National Trust and Savings Bank being a particular case where a light and air easement is specifically defined?
And that's true. That specific case, there actually was very specific language. But that wasn't the issue in the case to be resolved by this court. The issue in the case to be resolved by the court is whether or not, because the dominant estate changed from a residence to a business that had storage, did that destroy the easement? There was no question of vagueness or specificity, and that issue did not come up at all in First National Bank. But there are, I guarantee you, hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of light and air easements across the Commonwealth that could be affected by a determination by you saying it's vague. So there could be unintended consequences where people would read your decision and decide, oh, well, I guess we're going to ignore that light and air easement because the Virginia Supreme Court says it's saying it's vague. The last thing I would like to address
and Justice McClanahan indicates you've answered her question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call the next case.